Hey guys, welcome back to Table 40. Matt and Leslie here, and today we got a special guest. I don't say that every time, but this guy's really special.
Might be their favorite.
Yeah.
But this conversation.
I mean, he's the greatest storyteller of all time. Sean Casey, former Major League Baseball player for a long time, 300 career hitter, works for the MLB Network, father, amazing dude, really funny, one of the funniest people I've ever been around. He won, I think the biggest accolade is nicest guy in the league. How many years in a row? Like,
how about that? I don't know. I just won it like 1 year in 2007. Like, Sports Illustrated actually did a poll. But you know how they'll do a poll? They're like, hey, the last like six dudes, who's a nice guy in baseball? Like, hey, five said Sean Casey, one Jim Thome, and some guy said Mike Sweeney, you know what I mean, at the end. And, you know, but it was like 500 people, I think, players. And so that meant a lot to me because, like, you know, you pull that many players, it's kind of a cool thing. But, we know Lance Berkman well. You know, Berkey's great. You get over to first base. And I was just a chatty guy. Like, I love to, you know, talk to guys. So, like, you know, I got to know guys. So, it was pretty cool. I am thankful for that accolade. That was a cool one.
I think it's probably, like, one out of 30, though, right? I mean, because first base is really the only position that ever gets to talk to anybody. Oh. So, like, you don't even know if the left fielder or the right fielder is a nice guy or the shortstop, or maybe the shortstop a little bit on a pitching change.
Right.
No one would ever know if the outfielders were nice.
Yeah, you don't know. The only guy you really know is that first baseman. And if you don't like him, you know right away. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, this guy stinks. Somebody asked me that the other day on the network. They're like, hey, who was somebody that came to first base that, like, you know, didn't really talk to you much? And I was like, and it comes right away. Craig Counsell. Counts is a great guy, but he was like that, like,
serious?
You know, so serious, like, got to get my sign. Like pretend like, yeah, pretending like I'm not talking to him, Maddie. I'm like, hey, bro, what's up, Counts? What are you swinging, man? Hey, great day today. He's like, and then I'd be like, so then I would, like, he'd get his lead. I'd be like, hey, you clean it up. You don't have to be so serious, bro. Like, I'm not going to try and pick you off here or anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Relax. This is supposed to be fun. Yeah.
It's baseball, bro. It's baseball. I know we're getting paid millions, but let's go. It's baseball. It's a good time.
All right. Well, let's start out with tell us a little bit about young Sean Casey and the Casey family.
Oh,
I know
yeah.
that you think highly of your dad. I've heard you talk about your dad before and in your debut and stuff. But tell us a little bit about your growing up.
Oh, man. Where do I start? Well, I grew up – I'm in Pittsburgh right now in Upper St. Clair. That's where I grew up. Just great parents. My mom and dad, Jim and Joan Casey, they're still rocking and rolling. My mom turned 80 the other day. My dad, mom and dad are 80. They're just locked down COVID. Like, don't come over. You know what I mean? You got COVID. I'm like, I don't have COVID, Dad. Like, I you know, it's okay. You know, so, but my parents are, you know, my dad was a big baseball fan growing up. I always tell people, you know, people want to know why did you love baseball? It's like, well, I loved it because my dad loved it. You know what I mean? That's really why, you know, I love baseball. So, you know, he was a big influence on me, you know, playing ball. And, you know, my mom, you know, fast forward, though, my mom, like, you know, when you get, you know, Maddie, when you get to the big leagues, you know, there's something about calling home and, like, you just don't want to talk baseball, like, anything but. And, like, I remember my mom would answer every time. And Joan Casey gave me the gift of gab because she could talk for 2 hours. We wouldn't talk about baseball. And at the end of the conversation, I was like, I'm not sure what we talked about there. And that was a great conversation. You know what I mean? So, like, so, you know, I grew up with just great parents. I have an older sister, Beth, probably a way better athlete than I was. I was like a really good soccer player, soccer scholarship, University of Rochester. And people always ask me, like, I was a little chunky growing up. I know that might sound funny, but I was like the chunky kid. Like, my McDonald's would have like the 3 for 39 cent burgers. And we'd be like, let's go there, Mom, 3 burgers for 39 cents each. So, for some reason, we thought McDonald's was healthy back in the day. It's like smoking. You think, you know, back when my parents were growing up, they thought smoking was okay until they're like, hey, it's not okay. Well, I think that was the age of McDonald's for me. It was like, hey, McDonald's, it's a deal. You should go there. Until they realized if you take a McDonald's Big Mac and put it in a shoebox for 24 years, and 24 years later, the meat is still the same. The bread hasn't molded, and it's probably not digesting in your system. So that's what I was dealing with growing up was a little bit of weight problem here and there. But you know, it was funny for me too, because I could always hit, right? And like, I get to high school and everyone's like, hey, how come you just played, you know, baseball? You know, did you just decide to do that and start really focusing? And, you know, I'm like, no, here's my football situation. Freshman football, I get down there. like, they give me my uniform. I don't even know how to put the pads in. I'm like, hey, does anyone know how to put these huge hip pads in? The guy's like, yeah, here you go. So I'm like, launching these pads in. I'm putting the freaking knee pads in the thigh. It's crazy. I was late for the first practice. I'm like, so flustered. Then I finally get my chin strap on and helmet doesn't fit right. So I'm like, this is a nightmare. I don't even know what I'm doing. Because I was the fat kid, though, they're like, hey, you're a defensive tackle and offensive guard. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm not a bad athlete here. Like, why am I on the line? Like, I don't even know what I'm doing. It's my first year. So anyway, we get out there, boom, like first practice. I go to get my stance, Matty. Friggin' helmet falls down on my chin. I'm like, is this normal? Because I've never played football. I was like, is your helmet supposed to fall down to your chin or no? So they're like, no, you got to actually see the ball snap. So I'm like, oh my God. So I'm in my stance and I'm like, I'm holding my helmet up like that, like full fledged. And I remember the guy looks across me. He's like, Case, what are you doing? I was like, why aren't you doing this? Like, my helmet doesn't fit, I guess. So, like, set hike, and I just kept getting crushed, right? So I'm like, all right, I'm going to start liking football. All my friends like it. It's we're in Pittsburgh. You got to like football being here. You know, the yeah. Pittsburgh roots. Like, you got to love football. So first game happens. They're like, go in on goal line defense, Casey. So I'm like, all right, I go slushing in there. You know, I never had a good running style. It kept it through the big leagues, but at least I could hit that. So I come running out there. Freaking four-point stance. So I'm just letting the helmet rip. It's like down by my chin, and I'm waiting for the hike. Like, ready, set, hike. Freaking kid from Baldwin, town next to me. Boom! He crushes me. I mean, picks me up. I think he runs 4 yards of me, pancakes me. The running back comes. Boom! Steps on my chest. I'm like, ah! You know, I'm down for the count. But I was like, you know what? I'm ticked off here. This guy's gonna know who he just pancaked. So the play's over. The guy's looking over me like, yeah, take that. I grab him by the face mask, rip him down like I'm gonna do anything, pull him down on my wrist, break my wrist out for the season. That was my football career right there. So that was it. So I couldn't dribble, jump, or shoot. So basketball ended after my freshman year. I was decent freshman year. I was like the big kid just boxing the little kids out. Football ended with a broken wrist, and I was terrible, and I wasn't strong, and I was a little heavy at the time. So then I started just hitting every day after school. That's how I became a baseball player. And then eventually I started, you know, leaning out, getting a little stronger. And, you know, so what's funny is my stories, like, I do, looking back, like, love my story. My freshman year in high school, I didn't play much in baseball. And that was the one sport I was like, okay, obviously football's not going to work out. Basketball's not working out too good. I was the kid that dribbled to the corner. Like, don't dribble to the corner. I was like, ready, dribble, like, guaranteed, couldn't go left. Ready, dribble to the corner. Just like freaking turnover. You know, a turnover machine. It was unbelievable. So that career ended. So I was baseball, right? So my freshman year, I didn't play that much. I was like, you know, I had 15 at bats. And that was frustrating for me because I could always hit, right? And like, even coming up through the years, I was always one of the better baseball players. So I went to my dad. I'm like, Dad, I'm like, you know what? I was like, can you go talk to the coach? I was like, I'm not playing and I'm better than the kid that's playing ahead of me and all this stuff. And I remember it's so funny because I see my kids now and you think about that. You think about certain conversations you have with your kids. Like, are you doing your kids a disservice? Are you enabling, are you disabling them by enabling them? You know, that kind of thing. And this conversation for me was a game changer of my life, like literally changed my life. So I sat down with my dad and I was like, hey Dad, you know, could you talk to the coach? I'm definitely better than this kid. And he's like, you know what? I appreciate it. I know you love baseball. He goes, but I'm not going to talk to your coach. He goes, you're better than the kid that's playing, but you're not glaringly better. And he said, there's a batting cage that just opened up the town next to me. He goes, listen, the batting cage just opened up the town next to us. He goes, I'll make you a deal. You got to start working harder. Like, you got to start putting the time in, you know, because you got to be glaringly better next year than the kid this year, right? Well, they're not going to play him. I was like, man, you're right, Dad. So he was like, you got to put in the work. So he made a deal with me. And my dad didn't make a ton of money. He was a chemical salesman, you know, making 30 grand a year, probably grinding, traveling, just a wonderful guy, you know, a hard worker. He was like, I'll make you a deal. I'll pay for as many tokens as you want. As long as you go to the cages and you use the tokens, I'll pay for as much as you want. And I said, deal. So I went every day after school, starting my sophomore year, and I hit. And I found a guy that was a hitting coach. And this guy didn't even play college baseball. His name was Frank Porco. I end up hitting with him my whole big league career. Like, just a wonderful guy. Was like a second father figure. So I started to hit 15 years old. Wham, 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 wham. I start JV my sophomore year. It's funny now because kids are like, hey, I'm not starting varsity as a freshman. I'm like, freshman? I didn't even play as a freshman. I freaking, and then I was like, I thought my career was over. I, you know, made the JV team. I was just so excited to start JV. So I started JV, but then I just kept hitting. And I hit every day after school. And I would just, you know, it's funny. When I got to the big leagues, I always had that routine where I'm stretching, doing this craziness stuff. And I always did my batting gloves tight. Well, and everyone's like, why do you do your batting gloves tight? Well, I remember I had one pair of batting gloves. I used to hit all the time. And they used to really, like, get, you know, soaking wet. So I would just tighten them, you know, as tight as they would go. So I hit my junior year. I end up make varsity. I start. My senior year, I ended up, you know, starting again. And I wanted to play Division I baseball so bad. And my dad was like, it was towards the end of my senior year. Like I said, I wasn't the kid that, like, I didn't light up the you know, I ran a 60, I get cut at a tryout. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I was just learning to play first base. There were so many things just coming along. So, like, I didn't showcase well. Like, if it was this day and age, I had to go showcase, he'd be like, get this guy out of here. You know what I mean? Like, this guy's terrible, right? So, but in the game, I played well, like, double. And I would go to left center, Matty. You know, like, yeah. I just, my swing would just go there, right? So, my senior year, it's towards the end. I'm so frustrated. I know I can play Division I baseball. I've had some good, you know, Keystone State games, all that stuff. So my dad, like I said, was a chemical salesman. He had just started his own company, KC Chemical, and he was really been big into network marketing. Thousands of, you know, I know because I stuffed the envelope. It's like, it'd be like a Wednesday after school. He's like, all right, Shawnee, get you and Beth. We're going to stuff 5,000 envelopes. I'm like, what a nightmare. What a freaking nightmare. So I'm stuffing envelopes. So I know network marketing. My dad's like, if we get 5 people to respond, that's a victory. I'm like, okay, that's cool. So my dad comes to me. He goes, listen. He goes, if they're not going to go to you, go to them. He's like, he goes, if they're not going to come to you, he goes, sit down and write 30 letters. And he goes, and just start dishing them out to people who want to go. So I wrote one to Penn State. I wrote one to Clemson. I mean, now I'm dreaming because I have no offers. I don't even know what I'm thinking here, but I'm like, I'm going to throw them out there, see what happens. Yeah. So I send them out, and I'm sending them to Marietta, Division III, Wooster. I was John Carroll. I was looking for any takers, Matt. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, anybody, you know, take me. So the last thing was University of Richmond had seen me playing the Keystone State games. Never forget it. My dad brings up a flyer. So I wrote 30 letters to all these schools. My dad gives me a flyer. He goes, hey, send one to University of Richmond. They sent you a flyer last summer. I'm like, hey, all right. So I sign it, boom, boom, boom. And my dad's message to me was always this. He always said, you got to be prepared for the opportunity, like preparation meeting opportunity, right? He was always like, an opportunity is going to come one day. And he told me this freshman year. He said, it's going to come one day. It'd be a shame if you missed it. And I just always had it in the back of my head, like, I'm going to get the opportunity. Well, here I am at the end of senior year. I'm like, hey, is that opportunity going to come here?
Where is it?
I don't even have an offer from anyone. Like, nobody. So anyway, I sent out all those letters. Nothing happens. There's 4 games to go in my high school. We're playing this team called Montour, town next to us. I go 4 for 4, 8 RBIs. I remember, forget. 2 doubles left center, double dead center, double right center, right? So I had 4 doubles, 8 ribbies, and I'm just like, hey, it's a good game. You know what I mean? I'm not thinking much of it. I remember walking out to my position. My head coach goes, how many hits do you have today? I was like, 4 hits. How many ribbies? 8 ribbies, 4 doubles. He's like, that's great. He goes, you see the guy behind the dish? He goes, that's the University of Richmond head coach, pitching coach, Mark McQueen. He drove up to see you play. Well, he drove 6 hours.
Wow.
On a recommendation from a local scout. So he got my letter. He called a scout in the area, and the guy said, this kid has a really good bat, right? So he came up, and sure enough, man, like, he offered me a couple of days later, they offered me a $1,000 scholarship. I think it was 30 grand to go there a year. My dad made 30 grand. I was like, Dad, what are we going to do? Like, it's tuition's more than your salary. My dad's like, we'll take out a second mortgage. We'll figure it out. You know what I mean? So I ended up going to University of Richmond as the only offer. Like, I didn't have a Division III, II, nothing. I had one offer from University of Richmond. I went to University of Richmond. I ended up starting my freshman year, you know, freshman All-American. Sophomore year, I played well. Then I went to the Cape, and I played for Bill Mosiello, you know, who's now the assistant head coach at TCU. Played for him and for Brewster at the Cape. I beat out Helton for All-Star, end of the year All-Star. They're like, hey, who's the Sean Casey kid? I'm like, That's right, people.
Sorry about it.
Paying attention. Let's start paying attention. So I hit 340 in the Cape, led the league in RBIs, and I think because Helton was the big prospect, him and Erstad at the time. So, you know, Erstad became the first pick of the draft in 95, and he was, you know, out there in the Cape with me too. And so the next year I ended up winning the NCAA batting title. I hit 461 my junior year. You know, so from 3 years earlier, I don't have a college scholarship offer. So 3 years later, I was the best hitter in Division I baseball. Then I get drafted in the second round by the Indians. And then, you know, and then I just moved on from there. Like, you know, but I look back at that time, at that conversation, a 14-year-old kid, you know, kind of like, man, my sports career is going out the window, like in all facets right now. You know what I mean? I'm like, but that conversation with my dad to like, hey, you know, there's work to be done. And, you know, that it turned out I think that's how I ended up playing the big leagues, you know, and I ended up playing 12 years in the big leagues, you know.
That's so amazing. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, as a parent, because I know I've been there, like, I've watched, I mean, obviously, my sports pedigree isn't anything like the two of you, but I can see things, right? And so there have been times where I've watched some of my kids, and I can honestly say, like, yeah, you're not that much better than the kid that's playing in front of you. And so as a dad, did you have those experiences with your son?
Or yeah,
you have more than one son.
I have two sons. I have one that's 19 and then one, and then Jake, who's 17. He's going to Kent State to play. He's still a senior. Yeah, I have some of the, there's so much. It's so amazing as a dad now. Like, I can't believe I have, you know, I tell those stories and it feels like yesterday to me. You know what I mean? So to say I have, you know, I'm sure you guys have the same feelings. Like, you know, but watching my kids, one in college and one as a senior sons, you know, I remember telling my sons, like things don't just happen, right? Like, you don't just become a great baseball player. Like, you actually have to put in the work. Like, you actually have to, like, you know, I tell my kids, you create your habits and then your habits create you. Like, you actually have to show up. You actually have to create some habits that, you know, allow you to go out there and master the skill of hitting the baseball. And so what's amazing is I've watched the kids kind of get to that same age. I'm sure you've experienced too, about 14, 15. That's when they start showing up to the cages. That's when they started hitting every day. That's when they started getting bigger and started to lift and all that stuff. So, you know, for me as a dad, I always say, hey, listen, I'd love to see you hit every day, but I'm not going to ask you to go hit. You know, if you want to hit, if you ask me, I'll never say no. I go every time they ask me, but I'll never ask you to hit because I can't want it more than you want it for yourself. So, you know, and that's pretty much my dad. I mean, my dad, I don't even think he threw me one round of BP. You know, he's that dads are out there throwing BP. My dad didn't throw me one round. I just hit with the bootleg, like, golf ball, baseballs coming out. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I always wonder, man, I could, like, put a bad ball in play, like a bad slider. Like, oh, I nicked it to the pitcher. Like, because I think all those years of those bad balls, they'd come in and they'd have cuts in them. And I was, like, putting those in play. I'm like, oh, man, too much training on, like, some, you know, bad pitches.
That's so good.
So, yeah, I think it's a good encouragement to people, you know, to kids and to mom and dads who are waiting for these offers when they're, like, freshman and sophomore. Because I think some of these kids now and kind of the way travel baseball works is these kids are committed as freshmen and sophomores in high school. And then you got the kids that are a little bit later developers that say, well, I have one offer. Do I need to take this? You know, it's not a great offer. But as they're getting bigger, I'm saying, there's no hurry. There's no hurry to take it as a freshman or sophomore. Let's see what happens. If you're really good as a senior, they'll find room for you. And I think that that's a good encouragement to moms and dads that think they have to take that first offer when their kid's 15 years old, that, hey, just, you know, if it's not what you're looking for, then wait and keep, let your kid get better.
Well, what Maddie, like for you, like being a coach, you know, at Oklahoma State and obviously your brother and stuff like that, like, What is the reality though? Like with those kids, like, cause you know, there are a lot of kids. I know for me, when I went to University of Richmond, this is crazy. Cause I watched my son, like, they're deadlifting 450 pounds. Like, I remember freshman year in college, we line up to lift weights. They put 135 in the bar. They're like, all right, let's warm this up 10 times. Then we're going to move up and then we'll get into some squats and stuff. And I remember getting under the bar and I was like, oh my God,
I'm warm.
I had to dump it. And they were like, who's this kid? They're like, oh, this is a kid from Pittsburgh. We signed. We think he's a good hitter. We're not sure. You know what I mean? So like, I look back, like I didn't get bigger till like my sophomore year in college. So, like, for you guys to have to evaluate these kids at 15 years old, are you kidding me? Like, that's got to be crazy.
Well, ideally, we have to do it at a young age, because if we don't, other people will. I mean, yeah. Ideally, you'd love to be able to watch them into their junior and senior year, kind of more like basketball and football, where these kids commit more in their junior, senior years. You get a chance to watch them kind of develop. A lot of times, it's not, like you said, it's not the same kid as 14, 15 years old as is 18.
Right.
So I probably speak for my brother to say that we would love for it to back up, and even if the rules were changed, but it's just gotten so far down the road where, you know, 8th and 9th grade kids are wanting to commit, and you have to recruit them, because if you don't,
right,
somebody down the road is going to commit them. And so I don't know. I think it's baseball's in, I think it's in, that's, and maybe it's the travel ball and all of these, you know, these things that they do in the summer, which I think some of it's good. I mean, these kids get to play against the best competition in the country at a young age and kind of size themselves up, but some of it is just way too young, in my opinion. Yeah.
What about you, Leslie? Like, as far as Jackson goes, like, this, you know, he's a really good player, and he's just senior this year.
He's a junior.
And, you know, probably has a chance to get drafted and all that stuff. Like, but as a mom, like, from a different point of view, like, do you just let Matt handle the stuff with baseball and you kind of be mom, or do you kind of push him? And, you know, like, what's that dynamic like as a mom and that?
Well, you know, Sean, we had kids so young that when Matt was playing, they were quite a bit older. And so all the travel ball stuff I had to take him to. So I got to watch Jax, and I went to most of his games by myself. And so I was pretty involved, I would say, in a lot of the decisions as far as what team should he play on, and kind of evaluating, is this a good fit? Is this not a good fit? And I'm pretty involved in that part. Not as much now that Matt hasn't been playing the last couple years, and it's been nice because obviously he's the expert and I'm not, but I think I anchored that. Hey,
you let me handle the mechanics. You can talk to the boys about the other stuff.
And I would never talk to him about mechanics.
I'm just saying, like, you let me deal with the baseball stuff. You can talk to him about the mentality and stuff. She's tough. I mean, she's got the right, she knows how to handle them from the mental side, but yeah.
I would never talk hitting mechanics. I mean, because ever, under any circumstance.
You're not through the ball enough. You're not through the ball enough.
Yeah, I would never.
I used to, she'd FaceTime me or send me videos, and I'd tell him, hey, tell him this or tell him that. She's like, you want me to yell it from the stands? I'm like, no, just later, tell him.
It's interesting, but I think I'm probably more like your mom. I'm an encourager, but I'm also like, I'm not afraid to, you know, if it's not a good, because what happens with our kids, and I'm curious if this happened with your kids, it's like they'll kind of get slighted a little bit because my kids, quote unquote, are exposed to things just because of their dad. And right. So we've ran into situations that have been unfortunate, you know, especially with Jackson, when he was a little guy. And I remember, I mean, he's always been pretty good, and they'd bat him at the bottom of the lineup and all that. And I was different than your dad because I was like, what in the world's going on? And so I'd go talk to the coach, and I'd say, what in the world's going on? Why is he hitting 12? Like, what? First of all, why are you hitting that many players? And why is my kid hitting 12? So anyway, he's like, well, your kid's Matt Holliday's son, and he's going to get all this exposure. I was like, they're 10 years old. Believe it or not, no one is watching these games. And so anyway, so it's like that kind of stuff sort of went on. And I was involved in that. But as far as hitting mechanics, no. No, thank you. And any of that stuff, that's on Matt.
Well, the one good thing, the one difference I have in, you know, in my skills besides your husband's skills is I tell my kids, like, hey, listen, they'll have no pressure in high school. Because if you think I was this, like, All-American player, like, don't even worry about that. Like, I was the opposite of that. Like, no one even knew who I was in high school. You know what I mean?
That's great. All right, let's talk about Jesus. So I would love to hear your story, however you want to tell it, about your relationship with Jesus. So is this, I guess, like, I know for me, I was raised in a home. Both my parents were believers, and so we were raised in church. And I don't know if you share that and sort of your journey with your relationship with the Lord.
Yeah, you know what? I was born in a strong, you know, faith-based home. You know, we were raised Catholic. My dad was very strong in his faith. you know, I was just telling my son, you know, there's, you know, every day there's Catholic readings on like a mass reading, like the first reading and the gospel reading. Right. And so I really got to learn the gospels in high school. My dad was like, hey, why don't you follow along? It was my first intro to really the Bible. Why don't you follow along with the readings every day? The first reading, you know, a reading, you know, from a reading from Paul to the Romans or the, whatever it was, the Philippians or whatever, you know, the first reading, New Testament reading, and then the gospel reading. And it really, and then I would contemplate the gospels. And it helped me a lot to get to know who Jesus was, know who, you know, how he was as the man, you know, the obviously the Holy Trinity, all that stuff. It was such a big part of my life. And it was a big part of my life going into college. And I ended up getting together with a friend of mine. This kid, Jamie Capetta, was a freshman when I was a sophomore. And his good friend was this guy named Father Paul O'Brien, who studied at the Vatican in Rome. So it was like a really interesting story, right? And I connected with him big and got to know him a lot in the Cape Cod League. And so it was the first time I had I was able to really connect with my prayer life with a figure that was, that we could really go back and with a lot of theology and just learning the history of the Bible and just all the things that, you know, that relationship with Jesus and understanding what it meant for my life every day walking as a man. So that was my first, you know, intro, was just growing up in that, you know, growing up in the church. And then as I got into baseball, you know, I became the chaplain leader for the Reds and you know, I was involved in PAO for those first few years. You know, just, you know, Chris Rietsma, a lot of my good friends, you know, we found there was a lot of fellowship and just staying together and on the road and all the things of, you know, just, you know, having services on Sundays and our families getting together and stuff like that. So, you know, for me, my life, you know, has really been, you know, my faith has probably been the most important part of my life, you know, of everything. And, you know, even, you know, it's funny how life goes, you know, you'd like to think life is just perfect and on a platter and here you go, man, everything's perfect for you. And like, you know, for me, like, I have four kids and I got divorced, you know, a year ago. You know, we're probably in the process for 4 years. And, you know, you never think you're going to get divorced. You know, you never think that that's going to be part of your journey, especially your faith journey and you know, all that. You know, that was a devastating time for me, you know, really a devastating time. And I think, you know, leaning on my faith and leaning on the fact that, you know, like I'm a child of God first and that, you know, you make mistakes in life and, you know, things don't work out the way they totally should. But my faith is probably the biggest reason I feel like I'm, you know, able to walk with gratitude and thankfulness every day. Like I know the gift of life. I know the gift of, of what it's about. And I really believe the Holy Spirit's real and that it rolls with me every day and that, you know, I can have that connection and that, in my journey, like I'm never alone. Like I know at times when I was going through that divorce, like I did feel alone. And, you know, I feel like I jump back into my faith to really say, and God showed me again, like, it's just so crazy. Like, how would I ever think I don't think he's with me all the time, you know, which is crazy. And just really showed me he was there. And, you know, I'm just grateful for that. You know, like I said, it's not anything I would have wanted. I'm sure it's not anything my ex-wife would have wanted, Mandy, but it's, you know, one of those things where, it's okay. You know what I mean? It's okay to, you can get back on your feet and like, you know, and you still are loved and, you know, it's a wonderful journey.
So Sean, I got an email the other day from this sweet woman and she was talking about the podcast and she was just saying how she's been going through some rough things in her life. And one of the things she said is she said, man, I've just been hurt and I'm having a hard time understanding forgiveness. And as you were talking, I kind of thought, you know, we have some friends that know your ex-wife and they knew you guys as a couple and they were just devastated too to hear that you all were going through a divorce and the pain that must be for you and your family and Mandy and everything. And talk to me a little bit about forgiveness and kind of the things that you may have learned during that period of time. You know, I think that forgiveness is such a hard thing to articulate unless you've been in the trenches. And so I'm just curious sort of what your position on forgiveness or something you learned in your suffering in this world?
Oh, it's so good. Isn't that what it's all about? You know, I mean, isn't forgiveness, you know, isn't that such a, you know, a big part of, hang on a second. Okay. It's my daughter. You know, isn't that such a big part of like, you know, what our faith journey is about? And I think one thing that, you know, I'm proud of, you know, Mandy and I, as far as the kids go, is that, you know, we've really stayed, you know, amicable. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is resentments, right? Like, I can die in my resentments, and I can walk in bitterness, and I can walk in anger, and I can walk in all those things. But like, I don't think that's what God wants for me. And I don't think that's what he wants for Mandy. And I don't think that's what he wants for any couple that, you know, it has the misfortune of being divorced. I think at the end of the day, like, man, we're so forgiven. And, you know, God, you know, Jesus, you know, shedding his blood on the cross, you know, for us, you know, paid the ultimate price. I have to think that, you know, I think there's two things in forgiveness: forgiving yourself and then forgiving, you know, someone that's hurt you. And I think those are both tough things. And I think, but those, that's where grace lies. And I think knowing that there's so much grace here, and that, and, you know, I think for me, like, the forgiveness part is such a huge part, and it continues to be. And I just think that, you know, it's funny, because I think nobody wants to go through tough things at times. And, you know, I know when you do, though, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. You know what I mean? There is light on the other side. But I do know this, though, too, that without leaning on this Holy Spirit and without my faith journey, I don't know where I would have ended up. I don't know, you know, what that would have looked like. And I don't want to really think about that, but I do think forgiveness on so many fronts, you know, has been such a blessing. And I think, like I said, if there is no forgiveness, then there's resentment, and resentments, I feel like, will kill your soul eventually.
Yeah, for sure. A soul stealer, for sure. Yeah, I struggle with forgiveness sometimes too. So that's why I was curious when I got the email. I was like, man, I don't know. I'm going to have to ask some friends on this deal. Forgiveness is a tough thing to talk about. So you were the next phone call. So you got the question.
It is true, though. And when you get the gift, you know, gosh, I'm blanking on the book, but the guy that wrote Conversations with God, he wrote a book about forgiveness, and he basically says that, like, you know, if you were given the gift of forgiveness, then, you know, the opportunity to forgive, like, you know, usually if you're looking to forgive, it's probably a tough thing that's happened in your life, you know? So, you know, I look at it as a gift. It forced me to really look at myself and really turn the mirror on myself and say, you know, how could I grow even more in my life? And what resentments do I have that are stopping me from moving forward? And who do I need to forgive, you know, to do that? And including myself, you know, Because like I said, when you have a divorce, I don't know, my parents have been married 50 years. Like, it feels like a failure, you know, and I'm an athlete and you're in the game, you know, it feels like a failure. So, you know, you have to, you know, those are conversations with yourself sometimes at night when you hit the pillow and you're just like, you know, and I know for me, you know, getting grateful has been such a huge part of this whole thing. Just like gratitude that, like, no, like, there's only one me in the world, and I'm gonna look at that as a gift and be ultimately thankful, and I'm gonna stay in that vibration, you know, more than I'm gonna stay in the, hey, you did this. Hey, regardless of who did what, at the end of the day, there's got to be forgiveness to move on, because I know I don't want to live on that side either and blame people for anything that's happened in my life, you know?
No doubt.
All right. And much less, I think we'd be failing the audience if we don't have at least one good story.
Failing the audience, yeah.
I think a couple questions. Okay. So do your boys specifically, and maybe your daughters, Do they think you're as funny as I do? Like, do they think, like, when you call your boys and try to encourage, we were talking before the show started about your son was struggling a little bit swinging the bat.
Right.
Do you call him with a funny story? Does he think you're funny, or does he have to say, like, hey, Dad, you know?
You know what's funny is I do think, I think my kids do think I'm funny, or at least they pretend well, because they do laugh a lot. We do, there is a lot of laughter in our house. You know, there's a lot of laughter in the house, in our house. So I know my sons, you know, they laugh a lot, and you know, my daughters laugh a lot too. My youngest daughter, Jillian, who's 10, is like just a hoot. You know, she's just, I don't know if because she's the fourth kid, but yeah. You know, she's just a really funny person. But yeah, we have a lot of good laughter, and I try, you know, anything that's, it gets too serious at times, I always try and bring it down a little bit.
What, who's the funniest teammate that you played with that you thought was funny?
Oh my gosh. Pete Harnish. Pete Harnish is the funniest dude ever. I mean, just one of the funniest guys you've ever met. And, you know, he was, you know, you talk about Matty, you know, the season and the grind, you know, you need guys like Pete Harnish and, you know, Ryan Dempster's and, you know, those guys of the world to keep things light. Denny Nagel was fun. I mean, just
yeah,
a lot.
Skip Schumacher and the,
oh, yeah,
the
exactly.
Kuntelo and the guys, some of the guys that I played with. Yeah.
Yeah, man, you need those guys, man. Like, and so, you know, I was grateful because when I first got traded over to the Reds, like Pete was there as a veteran player, and you know, and not only that, he was like such a kind guy. Like we'd go out to dinner, and he paid for all the young guys, and you know, really taught me to pay it forward. Like, hey, when you start making some money one day, you take out the guys, and you go to Geno's East Pizza in Chicago, and you pick up the bill. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff. So
Mark Sweeney for me.
Yeah, was it Sweeney? Sweeney Dog? Oh,
Sweeney Dog. Sweeney Dog took care of me and paid for everything and make sure I knew. Someday that was going to be my job. So
yeah, it's great. And you remember those guys, you know what I mean? You remember those guys, and Sweeney's the best too, by the way. I played with him in 99 with the Reds. What a great guy.
Yeah. All right. So just to be respectful of your time, tell us, I got to have you tell the Bob Feller story. And I think, you know, at PAO, my stomach hurt. My face was hurting from listening to particular stories, but this one's probably a little bit more, radio friendly than the street in New York. Although maybe some other time we could tell that one, but tell the Bob Feller story as the young Sean Casey in spring training.
Oh my gosh. So 1998 is my, I've been called to the big leagues in 97, but my first big league camp was with the Indians was 98. And you know, I'm behind Jim Thome. So I'm like, I'm in trouble. You know what I mean? Like, we would do picks every morning. It's like me, Richie Sexton, Jim Thome doing picks. And I just hit 380 in AA. So I'm like, AA, AAA. So I'm like, dude, I'm one of the number one prospects in the game. Like, they got to tell Jim Thome to hit the bricks.
You thought he was old too, right?
I thought he was old. I'm like, this guy must be 36 because he's got like 400 homers. You know what I mean? Like, this guy, they got to be waiting for me to come in, right? So we're doing picks one morning and Jimmy's like, hey, Case, how old are you? I'm like 23. And I was thinking like, oh, here it is. He's going to tell me he's 34. I'm like, how old are you, Jimmy? He's like 26. I'm like, ah, I'm like, there goes. I'm like, I'm going to be out of here soon. Right. I'm like, I'm going to be, you know, there's no doubt. So in my mind, I'm like, I got to start doing something. Like I got to do extra. Like I got to show people that like, I'm, you know, I got to go a little brownie point stuff and I'm just racking my brain. So I'm like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start showing up to the dugout early. Right, I'm gonna start getting there as early as I can and beat everybody. So one day I show up early. It's like a 1 o'clock game. It's like 12:20. I'm in the dugout. I'm like, no one's in the dugout, but the Hargrove's down there. You know, Mike Hargrove, the manager's down there. But I want to show Mike Hargrove I'm there early. Make sure he knows, hey, I'm a good hitter. I just hit 380, buddy. In case you're not paying attention, and I'm early. I'm 5 minutes early before the game. You know what I mean? So like,
Jim's nowhere to be found.
What? What'd you say?
I said Jim's nowhere to be found.
Jim is nowhere to be found. As a matter of fact, he's probably still having lunch somewhere. You know what I mean? He's not even worried about getting the game. I'm full uni, spikes high, ready to go, batting gloves on. You know, so I get in the dugout. And Torrey Lovello's in there too, who's, you know, obviously Torrey's the manager of the Diamondbacks. You know, Torrey's kind of on his way out. He was, you know, grinding Buffalo, you know, up and down. And I'm coming in a young stud. So we're sitting there and full house. I mean, the Indians are the best team in baseball, hands down. They just lost game 7, 97. Winter Haven, Florida is packed in 98. I mean, you can't get a seat. Spring training, I'm like, this is unbelievable. So I'm sitting there, and Bob Feller is obviously a legend for baseball, but he's a legend in Cleveland, right? So Bob Feller every day would come out, full uni, spikes high. I think he's like 75, 70, I don't even know, 76, 7. And he would come out and they'd be like, ladies and gentlemen, get on your feet for the greatest American hero, the living legend, greatest pitcher of all time, number 19, Bob Feller. And he freaking, boom, Bob would hit his hat, place would go bananas. Freaking like, it was like Muhammad Ali was there. Just they were going absolutely nuts, right? And I'm like, wow, it's unbelievable. And if you go back and look at it, you know, Bob Feller, I believe, was in World War II when, you know, like prime years of his career. Like, he's like a legend. Like, him, Ted Williams, these guys took 3-4 years. If I took 3-4 years in my prime and came back to hit, they're like, you're out of here, buddy. You stink, right? These guys are 3-4 years, World War II, and then coming back and being the greatest pitcher ever, right? So he went through a lot and obviously battled a lot in World War II. So every day they would pick a player to to throw at Bob Feller. So after they announced Bob Feller, Mike Hargrove's like, hey, Case, why don't you go throw with Feller? I'm like, yes. I'm like, I'm kind of nervous, but I'm also like, I got 2 hits in the big leagues in 97. If I play catch with Bob Feller, I'll have 3 stories to tell. That's what I literally went through my mind. I was like, it's big time. I'm throwing catch with Bob Feller. So I go out there, I introduce myself. Hey, you doing, Mr. Feller? Sean Casey. How you doing, son? He's like, you throwing catch with me? I'm like, yeah, I am. So, you know, me and Feller start throwing catch, and boom, he gives it to me. And I say, I sing it back to him, get it back, zing it back to him. And then Tori Lavello in the dugout goes, Clay, he's like, Case, you got to clean it up, man. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you're lobbing it to Bob Feller, the living legend. Like, you're making him, you're showing him up. I go, I'm showing him up. Are you serious? He goes, yeah. He goes, at least throw it to him like normal catch. So I'm like, all right. You know, so now I'm all flustered. I'm like, you know, I think I'm doing the right thing, but I'm all flustered. So you probably never had this problem, Maddie, because you were out in the outfield. But for some reason at that time, I kind of had the yips playing catch. Like, and if you have the yips, there's only 2 things to do. You can either lob it like this or, like, get way back and throw it. Like, there's no, like, medium. Because if it's a medium, I'm sailing it or spiking it, right? You know what I mean? It's, like, so nerve-wracking. So I'm like, okay. Right when Lavelle tells me I got to throw it harder, I realize I got the yips. So I'm like, okay. So I start backing up. I'm backing up. And you could tell Feller's like, what's this idiot doing? You know, I'm backing up. So then I'm like, all right, Bob. I'm like, Bob, you ready? So I sling him one, right? And it's coming in. It was bad. I couldn't get the 4-seam grip. I think I got on the side. And just I 2-seamed it. It's coming in like it's dancing. And I could tell it's dancing. And then Feller's got his glove right here. And I'm like, so he's not moving the glove over. And the ball's getting closer. And I'm like, the heck's this guy doing? And here it comes, boom! It hits Feller right in the heart. He's like, and you see him like, all of a sudden, he starts like weeble wobbling like back, forth. And then he just goes, boom! And I'm like, oh my God! I'm like, I killed Bob Feller. I'm like, this guy's an American war hero, World War II, 3 years, you know, all this crazy. I go flying up. He's in the grass, just like face planted. Crowds on their feet, 8,000 people. You could hear a freaking pin drop. 3 blind mice could be there right now. You could hear them. It was unbelievable, right? And he's like, he's like literally like gasping for air. And I'm the first guy there. Like, I don't even know CPR. I'm like, my God, Mr. Feller, are you okay? You know, I mean, before you know it, here comes the EMT out of the stands. They're like, back up, son, back up. They're like, Mr. Feller. He's like, And I'm like, oh, my God, back up. So now there's a huge scene. It's quiet in the crowd. I'm backed up. I'm like, oh, my God, killed. And Lavello's like, did you kill him? I was like, I don't know. I hit him right in the heart. Hit him right in the heart with a 2-seamer. You know what I mean? So I'm like, oh, my God. So they get him. Here comes the training staff. Now the game's close. 15 minutes before the game. Now the players are coming out. Now it's commotion. Feller's down. I got 6 EMTs around.
What happened?
Oh, yeah. Training staff. And Tomey comes up to me. Jim Tomey, how ironic. Puts his arm to me. He's like, Case, what happened? Like, what happened here? He doesn't even know what happened. Like, he just knows I'm looking at the scene. I'm like, dude, I was playing catch with Bob Feller. I threw him a 2-seamer with some juice on it. Freaking hit him right in the heart. He's been down for 10 minutes. You know, so anyway, they get Feller to his knees. And I'm like, oh, God, at least he's alive. Crowd starts just unbelievable ovation. They're like, yeah, Bob. You know, they get him to his feet. They're like, Bob. No, they get him on his knees. Mr. Feller, what happened? He's like, oh. He's like, the young man over there threw the ball, and he's like, I went to catch it, but I jammed my shoulder golfing the day before. I just couldn't get that glove over in time. So I'm like, oh, my God, I'm sweating bullets. So anyway, they take Bob off into the ambulance, and Mike Hargrove, the manager who I was trying to impress, puts his arm around me. He's like, "Boy, Casey," he goes, "looks like you're the luckiest man in the world." He goes, "If you'd have killed Bob Feller, you definitely would have been released." I'm like, "Oh my God!" So that was my
traded like 2 days later, right?
I got traded 2 days later to the Reds. They're like, "Hey, good luck with the Reds." I'm like, "Hey, what happened here? Like, you almost killed the American hero. You're out of here, buddy. Bob Feller, see ya. Good luck in Cincinnati. They're like 30 games below 500. See you later."
That's incredible.
Oh, my face hurts again. Yes, excellent. Well, we really appreciate you coming on. We'll have to have you on again just to maybe tell some funny stories. But
oh, no, it's great. Anytime, man. I enjoyed this. I got many more stories where I came from.
Oh.
Thanks so much for doing this.
You got it. No, this, I really enjoyed it, guys. Thank you very much.
Yeah, man. We appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Table 40 with Matt and Leslie Holiday, part of the Sports Spectrum Podcast Network. For more stories on sports intersecting with faith, check out sportsspectrum.com.